Hello everyone, and welcome to the second instalment on Woolsey, Shedcast 9B, Arbiter of Christendom. We now have an idea, hopefully, of the rewards and practice of power for our hero. But the bigger historical question really, I suppose, ought to be, was he worth it? Does he deserve to be remembered all these years later as one of England's greatest statesmen? Now, G.R. Elton again had a rather cute line about questioning if Wolsey indeed had the right to be in the top 12 English statesmen of all time, even, he said, as 12th man. For those of you who are not aware of the ins and outs of the greatest game invented by humankind, which is, of course, cricket, a 12th man is a kind of cricketing equivalent of a substitute, so Elton was basically more than a little bit dubious. So, we're going to look briefly at the harder stuff, rather than all that fluff we covered last time. What did he actually do? What did he achieve? The phrases domestic policy and foreign policy, by the way, are deeply misleading. I use them with apologies, because they imply a level of structure, strategy and forward thinking that probably just didn't exist in these days. But let's look at domestic policy first, for want of a better phrase. Wolsey's first initiative was in a traditional failing of the medieval state, law enforcement. Between 1516 and 1519, he made a series of announcements in the king's presence. So, let's imagine we're an overdressed aristocrat standing around at the court trying to find the opportunity to impress the king and get a bit of the spondulix. Wolsey emphasised firstly that wrongdoing must be punished. Yep, fair enough, motherhood and apple pie. Every aristo could sign up to that. It must be punished wherever it was found. Yep, okay, so far so good. It must be punished regardless of personal influence or the social status of the accused. Huh? Slightly uncomfortable shuffling of feet. I mean, okay, but presumably you don't mean mean, do you? I mean, I'm an aristo. And finally, justice should be equally and impartially offered to all who sought it, whether or not they had the cash. Seriously? You mean even poor people? In a way, this is the most attractive feature of Thomas Wolsey. He had a genuine desire to make justice available to all, and a determination to attack and destroy sleaze in the law wherever he could find it. His method was to use the courts of equity, royal prerogative courts like the Court of Star Chamber, which he could control. And so he expanded the work of the chamber, bypassing many of the fees that lawyers earned through the common law courts, which made them rather inaccessible to the poor. He vigorously attacked the practice of the great and the good of maintenance, essentially corruptly manipulating the law in favour of your own people and servants, and we've heard of this many times. Wolsey did as much as anyone to enforce laws created since the time of Richard II. So, for example, Robert Sheffield was sent to the Tower. The Earl of Northumberland ended up in Fleet Prison, the Earl of Surrey was thrown out of the council chamber, and three Surrey justices of the peace were prosecuted in a show trial. This is really, really unusual in the medieval world, almost a sense of, dare I say it, social justice. Good Lord. The only niggle about all of this is that Wolsey couldn't resist a bit of double whammying. So, okay, he was quite rightly attacking great men for perverting the course of justice. But it did rather give him the opportunity to stick the boot into his political enemies at the same time. And the extra landing of the Doc Martin to the flawed aristo gave Wolsey's enemies further offence than maybe could have been avoided. And probably more importantly, further ammo to use against him. One of the great economic changes which started in the late 15th century was the enclosure of land. Essentially, as labour was scarce and expensive, enclosing arable land in favour of sheep meant better revenue for the landlords at a time of low demand for grain and high costs of labour. Medieval man had no economic theory to deal with this process. All they saw was a challenge to the traditional way of life and rights of the people as holdings were consolidated into pasture. Wolsey launched a campaign against the illegal enclosure of land, which again speaks to a man with a concern for social justice, for the defence of the rights of the community against the depredations of powerful landlords. And he carried it through. Proceedings were carried out against 264 landlords, and 188 of these cases ended with clear verdicts. Now that, for medieval justice, is what you call a result. Just to add a bit more grist to the social justice mill, he also prosecuted food racketeers from Star Chamber and fixed prices for meat and grain. Now, it has to be said that later on, Woolsey was forced to back off a bit on enclosures because he had to cut deals with the magnates affected to raise taxation to fund Henry's demand for foreign adventures. But he'd done a lot more than could be reasonably expected, and this is a bit of a theme, actually. Woolsey struggling in the face of demands from Henry that were close to impossible. If you're a Woolsey fan out there, it does, I have to say, go downhill just a little bit from here on in. So, as I've said, Woolsey joined the church for a career, not because he had a vocation particularly. But meanwhile, the proponents of the new learning were desperate for church reform, and as a legatus a latere, in addition to his secular position, Woolsey had an unrivalled opportunity to make a real difference, and folks like Thomas More and Erasmus were genuinely excited about what Woolsey might achieve. And it's not that he did nothing. He summoned church councils and convocations. He passed new constitutions for the parish clergy. But essentially, the reformers were to be disappointed. Very little substantial was actually achieved. On the other hand, Woolsey is accused of worse by John Skelton. He was accused of extracting fees as a papal legate. But in fact, the fees he took were very small and were certainly there to cover administration. But while we can clear him of charges probably as a vicious extortioner, he can't be counted as one of the church's great reformers. In education, though, Woolsey's sense of social investment and justice, if that is in fact a thing, is much more impressive. So Woolsey suppressed 30 redundant religious houses, and these are houses which were genuinely redundant and needed suppressing, not like the controversy we'll get later in the reign. And then, in a move spookily similar to the suggestion Anne Boleyn would make one day, he diverted those funds saved into endowing and building new colleges at Oxford and Ipswich. There were various objections about the methods and the way he went about it, and as it happens, much of what he did was undone by Henry VIII. But as far as Woolsey is concerned, his dedication to education looks pretty clear. In the end, one of the things that would sink Woolsey's career was the need to raise money. Now, the ins and outs of all of this are in the History of England podcast, but let's just say that the financial demands Henry VIII made in pursuit of his war aims were probably just insupportable. In desperation, at one stage Woolsey resorted to illegal taxation. That is, basically, a forced grant outside Parliament. We are told, are we not, that the size of the lie really doesn't matter, it's the way you tell it that really matters. And so, in this case, Woolsey decided to call this illegal tax the amicable grant. Well, it wasn't amicable. There were riots, it went pear-shaped, and Henry stepped in and had it cancelled, casually mentioning that it was all Woolsey's fault and that he, Henry, would never have done such a terrible thing, which was in all likelihood a complete porky, and a nice warning of how Henry would throw his loyal and hard-working ministers to the wolves if occasion demanded it. Despite the failures that Woolsey ultimately ran into, it's quite possible to argue, as I shall in fact be arguing, that Woolsey was pretty effective in delivering the king financial resources. To help cope deliver this, Woolsey introduced a new kind of subsidy, a subsidy based on a direct assessment of an individual's wealth. Taxpayers were assessed individually under oath by local officials. And meanwhile, returning to that theme of social justice, substantial numbers of less well-off commoners were completely exempted from the tax. Essentially, the subsidy was unusually progressive. And in his 17 years in power, he raised £565,000 in these new type of subsidies, and that's opposed to just £118,000 from the traditional taxation on movable goods and £250,000 on forced loans. So once again, let me point out to you a strong strand of social fairness in our friend Thomas, in his unusually progressive taxation. The fact that he ran out of steam and was forced into humiliating retreats over his amicable grant is certainly partly his fault. His political dominance gave him a propensity to steamroller rather than persuade and build support. But a substantial problem was simply that his boss was trying to compete with competitors in France and the Empire who simply had just far more resource than he could ever hope to have. And so again, the demands were unrealistic. Before we move, therefore, to the world of foreign policy, may I make one point. You might note that Wolsey's successes were not the sort designed to make him popular with the people that mattered politically, i.e. rich nobles. If he'd wanted that, he should have gone for things like they did in France, such as no noble is liable for tax. That would have been a popular move. Or passing a law saying peasants suck and you can enclose all their land because in 300 years it means we'll have a really efficient economy. Instead, he antagonised the flourishing legal profession by bypassing them in Star Chamber and therefore losing them their fees. He hacked off the landed classes with high and progressive taxation. Over to foreign policy, therefore, there are very broadly three views about Wolsey's foreign policies. And let me repeat the thing about the word policy being misleading and anachronistic, and let me repeat it with very shiny brass knobs on. So, theory number one is that there was no policy. Policy, schmolicy. Wolsey was just running around trying to give Henry what he wanted. Theory number two came from a chap called A.F. Pollard. He argued that Cardinal Wolsey was after a tiara. Now, my daughter was constantly after a tiara when she was young, so I have some brotherly feeling with Thomas. But Wolsey's eyes were specifically on a papal tiara, to become only the second English pope. And gentle listeners, can you give me the name of the first and indeed only English pope? It's a pub quiz favourite. Nicholas Breakspear was the man's name. Anyway, number three theory is that Wolsey was a man ahead of his time, who sought to deliver peace in Europe through the application of a concept that wouldn't really appear until the 19th century, the idea of a balance of power. That in a system where there are two gorillas beating their breasts and showing their bottoms to each other, namely France and the Holy Roman Empire, Wolsey would judiciously throw England onto the scales on either side as the occasion demanded, so as to maintain peace in Europe. And actually that Wolsey was managing fine. It wasn't Wolsey's fault that the policy was ultimately a failure. The problem was that Henry came in and messed it up, with constant demands to go and give France a beating. Theory number two, the search for a papal tiara, has probably now been finally and firmly rejected by historians. It did make kind of sense. We know Wolsey thoroughly enjoyed the power and influence delivered by his legatine status. It gave him enormous leverage in England. But Wolsey never visited Italy or showed any great deference to the Pope that might help him in a future election, or really any great dedication to curial politics. And that would have all been essential to win such a notoriously complex election. There was one occasion in 1521 when actually there might have been a chance of this. But it was driven by foreign policy rather than Wolsey's desires or politicking. And when Pope Adrian died in 1523, Wolsey had already pledged the Medici candidate his support, so there was no suggestion he'd go for it himself. Theory number three about the search for peace through the balance of power is interesting. Wolsey would have been well aware of the humanists and their impassioned pleas for the end of the constant war and a role for world leaders that sought perpetual peace rather than a search for transitory glory. In 1518, Wolsey did indeed labour to bring all three powers together and sign the Treaty of Perpetual Peace, which was about as perpetual as a mayfly. And it's true also to say that Wolsey and Henry's actions did seem to involve running around like blue-ass flies from one side of the boat to the other, first France, then the Holy Roman Empire, and then back again. So it kind of looks as though they were throwing England's weight onto different sides depending on the situation. But a balance of power attributes far too much credibility and far-sightedness to Wolsey. There's no written evidence to support the idea at all, and you'd think that someone somewhere at some point would have written about the policy that they were trying to maintain balance and so on. And on a couple of occasions, actually, it's also Wolsey, not Henry, who advocates aggression against France, which argues against the idea that it was always Henry demanding unrealistic schemes. Just as for domestic policy, it's easy to underestimate just how closely Wolsey and Henry worked together. But probably the best argument against the idea is that the facts fit theory number one so very well. Let's rephrase it a bit. Wolsey saw his task to win power, fame, and glory for his master in whatever way best presented itself. Whether that was by seeing Henry as the arbiter of Christendom, the author of a perpetual peace, or as the conqueror of France, empire, delete as applicable, or even, I don't know, winning the Bologna International Dog Show if that was what it took. Wolsey's policy was almost entirely opportunist. Henry maybe had more policy in mind, if crush the French counts as a policy, but as we've noted elsewhere, Henry was the most deeply medieval of kings. Glory was what he was after, essentially. So that all leads to the question, was Wolsey successful or was he not? Historians are often quite kind to Wolsey, often excusing him or pointing to some signal if temporary successes like the perpetual peace thing. But seriously, as far as I can see, the foreign policy of Henry was something of a disaster. This is not the place for the detail, otherwise we'll go on all day. But while earlier in the reign the vast outlay of public money at least generated some territorial return for the investment and diplomatic advantage, later in the reign Henry's search for foreign glory was crowned with miserable failure by and large. I have to say that the level of duplicity in international relations in the 16th century from my limited experience of Henry VIII is really quite shocking. I find myself reaching for the smelling salts. In particular, Ferdinand of Aragon should go down in history as the most shameful liar with the integrity of a card sharp. But hey, I guess that's international diplomacy for you. And the really depressing thing is that Henry and Wolsey seem to fall for it every time. Every time. I'm telling you. Duh. But for good or ill, whether it was mainly Henry or mainly Wolsey's fault, by the time the King's Great Matter came along, England was diplomatically isolated. And the Holy Roman Emperor, Catherine of Aragon's uncle, as it happens, held the Pope captive. This was unfortunate. It is certainly possible to see Wolsey as a man playing a bad hand with considerable skill, with his boss doing his best to hold one hand behind his back as he did it. But impossible to maintain, I think, that Wolsey in the end was successful in the tasks that he had taken on. In terms of the King's Great Matter, the divorce, it's a similar story, I guess. It's worth pointing out that by this time, Henry was a very different kettle of fish to the Henry of 1513. After 1527, he was in his maturity. He was much more involved in policy and much more assertive. He was also dealing with an area in theology in which he felt very expert. This was again, as it turns out, a bit unfortunate. Early in proceedings, Wolsey's plan was to use his authority as a legate to get the required annulment on a technicality, but Henry would have none of it. He was confident in his theology and his theological knowledge. He wanted to have the argument. He wanted to win it properly. He had more religious scruple, in fact, than either Wolsey or indeed the Pope. This is one of the deep ironies about the whole business of the royal divorce, was that all along Henry behaved with greater religious and theological scruple than either Wolsey or the Pope. It's also the case that by this time Henry had a new confidant, Anne Boleyn. I look forward very much to the time when we get into Henry and Anne's relationship and to the biography that I'll do about Anne, but for the moment let's summarise by saying that in a search for the divorce, Henry and Anne came across very much as a team, equals, discussing tactics and strategy on a day-to-day basis. In Anne, whatever he might have said later, and however much he might have tried to rub out her memory after she'd gone, he'd found someone in whom for at least a while he put his trust and loved more than any other person in his life, apart from himself, of course, but more than his old pal Wolsey. And so the dynamic had changed. Suddenly, Wolsey would find the ground had shifted beneath him, and the bedrock on which he'd built the foundation of his success had turned to sand. In May 1527, for example, Henry gave direct instructions to an envoy that he sent to the Pope. He also gave detailed instructions that Wolsey, quote, should not know. Because now, Henry felt the need to undermine Wolsey's stranglehold on communication channels with the papacy. He felt the need to have his own channel of communication. Because Anne and Henry suspected Wolsey was slowing down the divorce. They no longer entirely trusted him, Anne particularly. And in this situation, suddenly the combination of the roles of Chancellor of England and Papal Legate looked less like an advantage and more like a conflict of interest. It made Wolsey vulnerable to accusations of split loyalties, accusations that he was taking the Pope's side rather than the King's. Under the pressure of failed grants, the divorce proceedings, a more engaged Henry and the newly involved Anne, the relationship between Wolsey and Henry began to break down. They'd always got on so well before, they were almost mates. But Wolsey had also been getting careless. he was forgetting the cornerstone of his approach, the philosopher's stone at the heart of his ideology. It's the king, stupid. Keep him happy, and the rest can sing for it. He began to not only look like an alter rex, an alternative king, but to act like one. Let me give you an example. In 1528, the position of abbess of the convent of Wilton became vacant. It was a lucrative position by anyone's standards, and Anne Boleyn saw a great opportunity. And she bid to the king to make her sister-in-law abbess of Wilton. Now, this was bad news for Wolsey. He controlled these kind of things. What kind of an alter rex was he if he couldn't get his mates into plum jobs like this? And so he blackballed Anne's candidate. Actually, he made his case well. Henry agreed with him. Anne's sister-in-law had by no means a perfect private life. But the king promised Anne that Wolsey's candidate wouldn't be appointed either, to level things up. And then, before you could say knife, Wolsey went and appointed his candidate anyway. Oh dear. Wolsey had ignored the wishes of his king. He had resisted the royal will. Henry wrote Wolsey a letter that must have made his ears burn. Ah, my lord, it is a double offence to do both ill and to colour it. But with men that hath wit it cannot be accepted so. Wherefore, my good lord, use no more that way with me, for there is no man living that more hateth it. Ouch. Wolsey's enemies saw their chance at last. Wolsey's enemies being composed essentially of many of the nobles on the king's council, indeed most. In 1528 on the council, they published 34 articles against Wolsey. They planned that when the king brought them up in council, they would denounce him and have him arrested there and then. Everything was ready. The captain of the guard was warned. But the king ignored the articles. Humiliatingly, the plot to arrest Wolsey at the council had to be abandoned. But although the timing might have been wrong, the likes of the Duke of Norfolk were absolutely right in guessing the direction of the wind. In 1529, Wolsey was excluded by Henry from diplomatic negotiations with the French. Henry shared correspondence with the Dukes of Norfolk and Suffolk, and Wolsey's advice was ignored. This was calamitous. As far as Wolsey was concerned, this hadn't happened since he came to power, and he took it very badly indeed. There's much debate about Anne Boleyn's attitude towards Thomas. We're told that Wolsey saw Anne as an enemy and called her the Night Crow. And Eric Ives, the historian, has Anne working hard to prevent Wolsey and Henry from being reconciled. But often the level of rivalry is overblown. It is almost certain that at times they were rivals. Anne was Wolsey's rival for Henry's affection. Anne felt Wolsey was failing her in the divorce. But the idea that Anne pursued a consistent, vindictive and active campaign against Wolsey is very probably way overstated. Interestingly, just as Wolsey's preeminence had suffocated any point in having factions while he was in power, now that his power and influence were slipping, faction politics were back. Because courtiers now felt they could once again directly influence the king. And with the reappearance of factions, Wolsey found himself without political supporters, or at least any political supporters that really had power and influence. So the Boleyn faction, they wanted him gone. The Aragonese faction, they hated him for going after the divorce. And Wolsey was hated by all as an upstart from the wrong side of the tracks, and the humiliations of his years of dominance came back to pull him down into the abyss. So, on the 9th of October 1529, Wolsey came into Westminster Hall with all his train as Lord Chancellor. This had happened many times before, of course. The Cardinal knew how it all worked. All the important men, councillors, courtiers, they came with him to Westminster Hall, because they knew all the power and good things came from Wolsey's hands. But wait, not today, Zerg. The king's courtiers were nowhere to be seen. They'd all legged it off down to Windsor, to the royal court, because now that was where things happened. And that very same day, a writ of praemunire was issued against Wolsey. Now, praemunire is the law that the king's subjects can have no other master than him, that no authority outside the realm has any rights within it. It's a law aimed at the Pope, of course. Now, it would have been quite impossible for Wolsey, as papal legate, to be anything other than in breach of praemunire. And in fact, the Archbishop of Canterbury was in exactly the same position while we're about it. And Henry would have always known this. So it's an excuse. but Wolsey was forced to plead guilty and he resigned as Lord Chancellor. A week later, sentence was handed down, life imprisonment and the loss of all his royal offices and property. But Henry didn't impose the imprisonment. Wolsey was ordered to Esher, a town on the Thames. He took a boat down there, of course, and rubberneckers gathered on the banks, expecting to see him dragged off to the Tower, the fall of the mighty. But at Putney arrived one Henry Norris, who brought Wolsey's Henry's ring and a message telling him to, quote, be of good cheer, for he was as much in His Highness's favour as ever he was. And Norris hinted very strongly, pointing furiously at his winking eye, that he, Wolsey, should travel back to York and concentrate on being a simple archbishop, and maybe everything would be well. This might sound little enough. Wolsey had lost so much. But if you think about the brutality of the deaths of Empson, Dudley, Cromwell, Anne, Uncle Tom Cobbley and all, it's actually quite a significant offer that's being made here by the king. Basically, Henry liked Wolsey. He couldn't rely on him anymore, he didn't feel, but he didn't want his old friend to suffer. Disconcertingly for his enemies, Henry would also remark that none of them could manage business as Wolsey could. Wolsey's adversaries had no worries about making the cardinal suffer. The supposedly saintly Thomas More, for example, led the assault in Parliament, presenting 44 articles this time. They just wanted to take that cardinal down. But you have to find Wolsey a little culpable. He just could not give up power. He could not drink from the bitter cup of humiliation. He couldn't adjust to life as an Archbishop of York. Wolsey was now 60 years old. He appears to have had no desire to head for retirement in the way that once his mentor, Richard Fox, had done so years before with such delight. Unfortunately, Wolsey couldn't give it up. As it happens, one of the servants who stayed with Wolsey right to the very bitter end was one Thomas Cromwell, a fact that speaks well of him and has been used fully by Hilary Mantel, of course. Over the course of the next few months into April 1530, Wolsey desperately tried to re-establish contact with the Henry and build an alliance even with Anne Boleyn, all to no avail. But Henry remained lenient. Finally, Wolsey took the hint and he headed north to York in a procession of such magnificence that no one could believe he'd lost favour at all. But it was simply defiance. Then in October 1530, news arrived of a papal brief ordering Henry to separate from Anne Boleyn. The rumour was all about the court that this brief sent by the Pope was the cardinal's doing, a bid to regain influence by then being asked to step in to sort it all out. Whether that was true or not, and it'd be pretty Machiavellian, it was the last straw for Henry. He seemed to think that the cardinal had indeed been dealing with foreign powers, and if the charge of praemunire had been a little harsh before, it was now pretty accurate. So on the 4th of November, the Duke of Norfolk, probably with great joy, took Wolsey into custody on the charge of high treason. On the 6th of November 1530, Wolsey made a tearful departure from his household and started the long journey south. On the 8th of November, he stayed at the home of the Earl of Shrewsbury, and he stayed there for over 2 weeks, for two reasons, it appears. Number one, he was in a panic, and number two, he'd genuinely fallen ill, probably with dysentery. But he had to keep going, and he arrived at Leicester on the 26th of November, now so ill that he probably realised that he'd joined Richard III 6 feet under. And duly, on the 29th of November, at Leicester, he died, uttering his famous words, "If I had served God as diligently as I have done the king, he would not have given me over in my grey hairs." Not sure he was right, actually. As far as I can see, if you served the king in any capacity, you were pretty much done for. But who knows? So there you go. Cardinal Thomas Wolsey. Quite a character, I think. And I find myself a bit of a supporter. I probably find myself more a supporter as the aristocratic hatred rose around him when his fear was gone. Here, for example, is Francis I, King of France. Clearly more than a little affronted at the damage done to the great chain of being by Wolsey. He told Francis Bryan that he was sure so pompous and vicious a heart, sprang out of so vile a stock, would once show forth the baseness of his nature. At court, the Duke of Norfolk did the courtly equivalent of dancing on Wolsey's grave, with the production of a satirical play called Of the Descent of the Cardinal into Hell. Poor Norfolk. Just when he thought it was safe to go back into the water and he'd got himself a nice, safe Chancellor in Thomas More, he'd find himself dealing with another of the NQOCD in Thomas Cromwell. It speaks well, again, for Henry that he should want men like Wolsey around him. A man from the wrong side of the tracks, but with a talent. A big man, mentally and intellectually, with the style to match. The glorious peacock with a silver tongue and a quick wit, a consummate politician. But the determination to see justice done, to support others with the education that had given him his chance. And these are great things. But surely Elton has a point in his wisecrack about Wolsey only just being good enough to make 12th man. There's nothing really of a coherent guiding spirit or strategy or great idea in the life and works of Thomas Wolsey. More just of a desire to succeed, to get the job done competently and work hard, which is great, but limited. Not much more to just then enjoy the power that came with success. There's nothing wrong with any of that. But it's hardly a Gladstone or a William Pitt, if you see what I mean. Super great, there we have Thomas Wolsey for you. Next time, there'll be an episode of The History of Scotland, and then after that, it'll be a break from biography to cover the wonders of the medieval tournament. Until then, good luck everyone, and have a great time.